The Internet Research Agency looked like any business in an office in St. Petersburg, Russia. Fluorescent lights, whiteboards, meeting rooms, like any other digital business. Except, instead of trying to build something up, this troll factory was in the business of dividing and tearing down reputations.
So basically, it's true. 24/7, people who are working away on the internet to penetrate each and every outlet of it.
It reverse engineered the promise of the internet bringing the world together, the assumption that people in democracies worked under.
Facebook, Twitter, each and every magazine, each and every internet edition you can think about. You know, they do videos, they draw pictures, they write pieces, you know, on each and every subject. Believe you me, they're there.
Lyudmila Savchuk is a journalist who worked there undercover. This is a translation of Lyudmila telling her story after the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
Many of the offices in this four-story building were open, so I was peeping in and checking out the rooms, and I was shocked to see clusters of many people, and it was amazing how there were so many of them concentrated in one room, typing away. They pretended to be citizens, the residents of this teeny tiny village or town, and they say hello as if they are neighbors and are residing in the same district to say, I'm Sasha, I live in this and that area, on this and that street, and somebody replies, oh, I'm Olya, I live here. Oh, and by the way, did you hear what Obama's done this time?
But fostering division took organization.
The first instructions that the new trolls, the new recruits, receive from the troll factory is that they have to pretend to be as humane and human as they can possibly be.
Lyudmila says the man working next to her pretended to be a mechanic for classic cars from Mexico.
So you cannot tell between them and real people. Basically, it's an opportunity for them to live a life they always dreamed about and to pretend to be somebody else. They can be gorgeous, you know, knockouts, they can be bodybuilders.
Blended in with all that human interaction, the messages were consistent about certain things. The U.S. was in decline, Russia under threat, and events were out of control in other countries. The point was to shape public opinion in Russia, or to change minds and make false impressions in the U.S. But perhaps you already know this about the troll factory. Maybe you even know about the man behind it.
Well, you know, the owner is Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's a total jerk-off.
Reports emerged that a plane reportedly carrying Yevgeny Prigozhin had crashed. The jet, according to the tracking site, dropped 8,000 feet per minute before data transmission stopped.
The same Yevgeny Prigozhin who set up a mercenary group, Wagner. He then famously challenged Vladimir Putin in a mutiny which ultimately cost Prigozhin his life. But in 2016, he was known primarily as the shadowy figure behind the unusual trolling business which did this unholy work.
And do you know how he releases his stress? He takes tons and tons of mannequins to the outskirts of the city, shoots them down. At some point, I felt like that mannequin.
But this troll factory is just a fraction of what people linked to Russia did during the election of 2016.
The whole thing was designed by people whom we in Russia call political technologists. So the people who normally do nasty part of the political campaigns.
It was that mobilization of energy. So it wasn't just people believed a crazy idea. It was that you went from introduction of idea to mobilization of American subjects.
We were all like, this is bullshit. These are the Russians.
So finally, we're dedicating huge amounts of resources to manipulating elections in America.
How are you useful to Russia? If you are destabilizing the West, and if you're especially destabilizing the U.S., you're useful to Russia. If you're an American who's destabilizing your own country, then you're a gold mine.
So to the question of anger that you're interfering in the U.S. election.
Well, it's what our readers demand, but it's also our basic principles.
This is Dark Shining Moment, an original podcast from Ranieri & Co. This series explores how in 2016, Russia exploited the internet to mess with Americans' minds. This podcast tells the story of some of the first people to notice Russia's interference in the election. It's an account of the moment democracy itself was swallowed up by social media and digital communication. It's the moment that kicked off the crisis that we're in today. To understand what's to come, we need to understand what happened in that pivotal year. I'm Chris Cipone. In its lifetime, the bulk of the IRA's work was focused on shaping attitudes of Russians. But it was in 2015 and 2016 when the IRA did its most famous work. That's because in those years, the Troll Factory, among other groups, was used to disrupt the American election, to attack Hillary Clinton, and in the process to help the most disruptive candidate of all.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Sorry to keep you waiting. Complicated business. Complicated.
Donald J. Trump.
Thank you very much.
In 2016, I watched as the pro-Kremlin trolls disrupted a U.S. election and helped shape its outcome and how we think about it today. But I was watching from Melbourne, Australia, where I've worked for more than a decade in international news at The Age and sister publication, The Sydney Morning Herald. I could see how information was being used in new ways to drive political outcomes, how it flooded platforms, or how mobilized masses could swarm targets. Pro-Kremlin, or at least anti-US figures, exploited technology in the same way that early jazz musicians invented their genre. It was the same instruments, but they were used in totally new ways. To really understand the scale and ambition of Russia's online influence machine, however, we have to go back, away from St. Petersburg, away from the U.S., back in years to a very different place. Phil was a young American who was working in Afghanistan in 2008. The post-9/11 global war on terror had shifted focus to Iraq, with Afghanistan becoming less of a priority for the Bush administration. Like many Americans in Afghanistan at the time, Phil worked as a contractor for the U.S. government, trying to put the country back together again after years of fighting.
I was an engineer responsible for certain critical computer systems, and I led a team of Afghan engineers supporting them. I lived in a fortified compound within the Green Zone in Kabul. It was a heavily guarded area, and it housed embassies and aid organizations.
Phil is not his real name. I'll explain why I'm not using his real name in a bit. One night, Phil found himself in a conversation. Now, this particular conversation took place in the compound where he and the other contractors and aid workers lived. Some of the people had been sent to Afghanistan from democratic countries. Some had been sent from less democratic countries. All of them were in the business of nation building in this conflict-torn place. And all of them were there in the hopes of combating terrorism. Each night, a group of colleagues would share a meal, then linger afterwards for drinks, glasses of wine, bottles of beer, and a good conversation. Among them was another man, Alexei, who was a Russian, a well-liked and avuncular figure. There had been some news that day.
This was the scene early on August the 8th, 2008, as Georgian rockets pounded the breakaway region of South Ossetia.
After what seemed to be a worsening diplomatic crisis, Russia and Georgia went to war over the disputed regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. More than 400 people were killed.
It was the opening of a devastating five-day war between Russia and Georgia, with each side blaming the other for setting it off.
We were talking about the news from Georgia, and of course, given the backgrounds of everyone around the table, everyone had their own take. And probably, being in a war zone made it feel more urgent.
Then, as the conversation flowed, Alexei became agitated.
He was upset that others were assuming that Russia was at fault, or that Russia, which was trying to pry away sovereign territory from Georgia, could even be seen as the aggressor.
An argument flared. The conversation around the table grew heated. Phil and the other Westerners didn't expect such a fierce reaction to what, on the face of it, were the pretty undisputed facts of the Russian-Georgian War. Because of concerns for his personal safety and the safety of the people he worked with, Phil asked that we not use his real voice.
We were winning arguments on factual grounds, but Alexei didn't change his mind. Also, his arguments had a larger frame about globalization that I hadn't noticed before, except Alexei didn't call it globalization. He called it globalism. He said it was a plot to surround and destroy Russia.
Now, this conversation took place back when tensions between Russia and the U.S. were at a low simmer. It was 7 years after September 11th when Vladimir Putin called George Bush to offer his support. After the surprise argument with Alexei, Phil was curious. He wanted to know where in the world Alexei was getting these ideas, that Russia was under attack, that Georgia, the smaller state, was the aggressor, and what was globalism? Later that evening, downstairs in his basement office, filled with inexpensive, self-assembled furniture, laptops, maps on the wall, on the floor, computer cables ran over the edges of the Afghan rug. In the humming clarity of the overhead fluorescent lights, with Alexei's arguments fresh in his mind, Phil booted up his computer and Googled. The results showed Alexei was making the same arguments found on Russian government websites. Phil called over a colleague.
We found articles quoting Vladimir Putin accusing President Bush of orchestrating the war in Georgia, and that it was a plot to get John McCain elected to the White House. It was so strange. Alexei presented as a normal skeptic, but on this stuff, he was in a different place.
Phil kept searching. He started Googling the exact phrases Alexei was using.
Alexei made arguments like the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs was making, and quasi-official Russian state outlets were making. Then I noticed Global Research, a 9/11 conspiracy site from Canada. Alexei was making similar arguments to it.
There's ample evidence to suggest that the Bush administration were involved in acts of complicity and camouflage with regard to the events of 9/11. And this is not simply a question of foreknowledge.
But then, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Global Research, well, they weren't the only ones echoing the themes. They were appearing on other fringe sites, sites that Phil had seen other Westerners accessing in Afghanistan.
What's fun is laughing right back at these psychopathic bastards.
For example, the site of the outlandish conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
He loves betraying people. He gets off on it. He's committed to Satan. I don't like him putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Serious crap.
As well as claiming the Sandy Hook shooting of 20 children in 2012 was a false flag incident, Jones would urge Trump followers to march in the Capitol in 2021. But in 2008, Jones was more focused on the New World Order. In a twist, Jones was presented on Russian TV as an investigative reporter.
Jones said he was ashamed to be an American because America was helping Georgia, the smaller ex-Soviet state, beat up on Russia, the historical hegemon of the region.
First off, let me say I am ashamed as an American. I'm a loyal American who loves my country, but my country has been taken over by a private international military-industrial complex, and they launched a sneak attack on the Russian enclaves of Abkhazia and other areas, as you know, on 888, using the cover of the Olympic Games and a dastardly sneak attack on the order of Pearl Harbor in World War II.
In contrast to Jones's claim, the reality was that the U.S., under George W. Bush, did almost nothing when the Russia-Georgia war broke out. Phil noticed more websites peppered with articles with a conspiratorial slant. Some of them were, on the surface, focused on international relations. Some were more esoteric. The site, What Does It Mean?, described the Russia-Georgia conflict as
an unprovoked attack by U.S. and Israeli-led Georgian Special Forces troops, which was deliberately timed to coincide with Prime Minister Putin's absence from Moscow.
The report claims the U.S. knew of the war and planned to use it as cover for a limited nuclear strike on Iran. What does it mean? Then says Putin intervened with the U.S. military to have a U.S. officer who was planning a nuclear attack removed from the nuclear weapons chain of command. None of this happened. Rather, the report on the conspiracy used real events, the war in Georgia, as a news peg for fantasy. Some of these same alternative news sites would later prove crucial for flooding the U.S. election with disinformation in 2016.
Night after night, I Googled what Alexei said at dinner, and those narratives would invariably be found on fringe websites. Some sites weren't focused on politics at all. They weren't even focused on what would be called reality. They were websites with content about aliens, astrology, hidden truths, and myths. Websites with posts about Area 51, where aliens supposedly landed, and the CIA's purported role in the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Twin Towers, they appear to have fallen immediately, as you would have buildings fall in a demolition. We've seen that on TV many times.
Look at it again. The astronaut is getting up with the wire taking the weight, relieving him of 5/6 of the Earth's gravity. A magic trick? No, just the help of a wire man.
So here was Phil in the fortified compound in Kabul, in his basement-level office, peering into the landscape of websites that ranged from radical news sites, finding the audiences alienated by America's rush to war in Iraq, to others that frankly portrayed an alternate world entirely. The scale ran from news to conspiracy. One theme that tied these sites together was a pervasive idea that reality itself couldn't be trusted. There was an unseen truth, the sites hinted, just beyond our reach, either metaphysical or religious or conspiratorial. Even the names of the websites hinted at this theme.
Cosmic scientists, the truth seeker, the unhived mind, government slaves, wake up the sheep.
There was a kind of hyperbolic alarmism, anti-Western conspiracist insinuations, racism, gold standard nuttery, and a zeal for attacking the U.S. dollar. The sites were mostly for 9/11 trutherism, but also featured anti-Semitism, anti-globalism, anti-vax, anti-GMO sentiments. And here was the weird part, the really weird part. When it came to topics of relevance to the Kremlin, they had an unholy coherence, always a suspicion of the U.S. and Western power, but a kind of dovish or neutral approach to any Russian aggression.
American Western New World Order system based in, of course, London and New York and D.C., they have hijacked the U.S., they have implemented continuity of government, Europe, and Central Europe, and I really appreciate the fact that Russia has been restrained in all of this.
It became weirder still.
We noticed that what Alexei said could be found across these seemingly unrelated sites, ranging from the Kremlin to Alex Jones. What they had in common was a tendency to repeat the same conspiracy.
This was in 2008. At the time, the banking collapse was happening in the U.S., triggering market plunges and a steep recession affecting millions of Americans. But on Global Research,
the House of J.P. Morgan have deliberately triggered bank panics behind the scenes in order to consolidate their grip on U.S. banking.
For weeks after the argument, Phil listened to Alexei in the evening. Narratives Alexei used appeared again and again on the fringe conspiracy sites. Phil would pick up items on these sites, and he noticed that Alexei used them. One night, Phil and his colleagues asked each other, what exactly are we looking at here? Why was Alexei, a realistic and respected specialist working in Afghanistan, making arguments found on conspiracy theory sites about UFOs?
We were like, Jesus, how big is this stuff going on here? It was shocking to me.
The pattern was there, but a pattern of what exactly?
We noticed how, when a message changed on a certain subject, like NATO's expansion eastwards, for example, the messages on a group of varied websites would change as well. We saw how obscure, pseudonymous websites all moved together, like a school of fish.
It's entirely possible the sites reflected nothing more than their authors' openness and suggestibility to themes preferred by the Kremlin. Or there could be another incentive. What was clear was that the sites together provided a massive counter-narrative to the mainstream understanding of current events. This counter-narrative reverberated around the internet.
It became clear that we stumbled across a fairly large influence iceberg.
But an iceberg of what, exactly? In 2008, this sort of material flourished online in the gaps left in coverage by traditional media outlets. Conspiracism was found on small websites and blogs with growing audiences. Phil recognized that in the internet age, people were free to post what they liked. That was freedom. But no one in their right mind would believe this, right? This material was simply too extreme. But then there was Alexei. He seemed to believe it.
The phrase, 9/11 was an inside job, is familiar to most Americans, even if they don't agree. That's an idea that has been relentlessly promoted across these networks since just after the attacks. I knew people back in the US who were 9/11 truthers. That's just one example of how Russian propaganda left a mark.
This was propaganda that supported Russia obliquely, indirectly. More than anything, it bolstered divisive ideas in American debates.
We saw how the sites intensively promoted and supported Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. This was clear through overt state propaganda outlets like RT and Sputnik, as well as through numerous more subtle front groups and agents of influence.
This stuff tilted the edges of reality, a world where you couldn't talk about the 9/11 attacks without spending time denying it was an inside job. Untrue things were being driven towards the center of discussion.
Being in a combat zone, then finding this network of content that wasn't true, but somehow interacted with news, it was weird.
Phil made out dimly how information in this way was a type of power.
We came to the conclusion that our culture had been changed directly by the enemy.
Phil and his colleagues thought to alarm people in government to what they were seeing. In an era still defined by the war on terrorism, efforts by Phil to raise the issues around these websites with State Department people didn't go very far.
A lot of modern counter-propaganda grew out of countering violent extremism, which was palatable to the politics at the time. What we were talking about just didn't fit in with that narrative.
This was something else entirely. It wasn't about war. It wasn't about terrorism directly. It wasn't about countering violent extremism. What Phil stumbled into didn't really fit into any category. And there was another thing, a big thing. This content may have been untrue, even fantastically so, but that didn't make it illegal. Outside of terrorism, crime, and online child abuse, there was no bureau in a democratic government that tracked the words and pictures of websites of its citizens. In 2008, individuals sounding off into the ether about UFOs and supernatural beliefs didn't fit into anyone's box to worry about. It was a conundrum Phil would have to set aside. It would all come roaring back. Back in St. Petersburg, where Ludmilla had exposed Prigozhin's troll factory, she was increasingly harassed by the Kremlin-loyal media and by critics. She received threatening calls. As paranoia grew in Russia in the ensuing years, the promise that the internet could bring people together, that it could liberate people, well, that dream was ever more remote. Aggression became part of the fabric of the internet. Of all the operatives, Yevgeny Prigozhin was just the most famous, the most gangster. So in August 2023, with the news that Prigozhin, the kingpin of the St. Petersburg trolling op, had died after his jet crashed, Ludmilla could ask only one question. She posted it on social media the day Prigozhin died.
Am I really free?
Next time on Dark Shining Moment, how did the government track terrorists if it had no ability to follow them?
There was no interest in the U.S. government's part. This would be, say, 2014. No interest at all, really, in anything related to the Russians. It was just not felt to be important.
One Twitter account was even called Team Trump Russia.
just watching this happening and watching the sort of the larger American political thing happen, it was this slow unfolding nightmare.
Dark Shining Moment is a Ranierian co-production, reported and written by me, Chris Sapone. Sound design by Martin Peralta. Executive producer, Greg Mueller. Consulting producer, Richard Baker. And managing producer, Nick Randall. The opening theme is Rainbow Death Revisited by Votaries, courtesy of Wharf Cat Records. For this episode, Phil was voiced by Jeff McGann. Lumilia Savchuk is voiced by Tysia Payne.